I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Eight cases of measles have been reported in Johnson County this month, and it's got many people wondering just how to protect their kids. Today, children's health experts help us understand the disease and how to prevent it. Then, with the warmer weather coming up, summer sports season is right around the corner. Baseball, camping, bicycling, and more may be on your family's agenda, but a nasty sunburn isn't the only risk. We'll find out how to prepare the little ones for a safe and happy outdoor season. We'll close the hour with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. At last count, Johnson County had eight reported cases of measles, an unusually high number given that as of late February, the CDC was reporting just 13 cases nationally. Now, as part of our monthly Kids Health series, a look at a disease that's as troublesome today as it was when I was a kid. Later on this hour, we'll talk about making sure your child is ready for outdoor activities if it ever warms up out there. With us, Dr. Natasha Burgert. She's with Pediatric Associates just north of the plaza. She's our regular guide on our monthly children health shows here. And Natasha, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Also with us is Dr. Robin Livingston. She's the medical director of infection prevention and control over at Children's Mercy. Dr. Livingston, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's straighten out this issue with the number of cases reported in Johnson County versus what's been reported across the country. The last count of the number of measles cases in Johnson County was eight. The last count I saw for the total number of measles cases across the country was 13. Do you have more updated numbers here, Robin?
Yes, I do. I spoke to the Johnson County Health Department last evening, and we're expecting another press release to come out sometime today, where I believe they're going to take that number of cases up to 13.
From 8 to 13.
Yes.
And nationally, that would match the number nationally as of a few weeks ago. So how do you explain that?
The number of cases varies per year. I mean, remember, measles isn't endemic to the United States anymore. It is usually brought in by a traveler. So depending where these travelers go, if there's measles in those places, do we increase the risk of bringing that back to the United States?
Does all this mean that we have become ground zero here in America when it comes to measles cases?
I don't think so.
Why not if our numbers are matching the national numbers?
Mm-hmm. As I said, they vary throughout the years. I mean, we've had as little as 37 cases, I believe, back in 2004, and a maximum of almost 700 back in 2014. When a case of measles, typically from a traveler, comes back to the United States, it also depends on what community is that measles case coming back to. Are you coming back to a community where individuals are highly immunized, so the risk of an outbreak would be lower? Or are you potentially bringing measles into a community that is not highly vaccinated and then the risk of spread is increased?
Hmm. What do you make of this? As you look at this, Natasha, this fact that there are so many cases here in Johnson County.
Well, I don't think for those of us who take care of kids with infectious disease, it's necessarily surprising. Measles is one of the most highly contagious diseases on the planet. And so when you do have a traveler coming into the area, it's not, you know, we expect these numbers to climb. I think what's panicking most parents is its unpredictability, and that especially and specifically with, not unlike other infectious diseases, but measles, you're spreading around before you're really symptomatic. And that's really terrifying for a lot of families, especially for those who have young infants who haven't had the opportunity to get vaccinated yet.
Does that make measles unusual in that it's spread even before the symptoms have hit somebody?
No, that's how infectious disease works
that's a lot of the time.
And that's how we even spread things as simple as colds. But measles is particularly unique in its level of contagiousness. And we were in the international news, I think, was particular interesting just this last month in Melbourne, Australia, where they had a small outbreak from travelers together just in the baggage area spreading measles to each other. So it's not even in a confined space in which where you can spread it. And so it's, you know, it's appropriately concerning for our families here in KC.
Okay. Parents will want to know, Robin, how can they stop their kids from even getting the measles to begin with?
Well, the best source of prevention is vaccination. So most children are eligible to receive their first MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, within 12 to 15 months of age. And the second vaccine is usually given during school entry. Now, if a child is planning to travel abroad, that vaccine can be given as early as 6 months. It doesn't count towards the vaccine schedule where you typically need two. But if vaccine is given at 12 to 15 months of age, there really is not a reason that the second vaccine cannot be given as early as 4 weeks later.
Huh. So you can get them as young as 6 months old?
For travelers.
For travelers. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why not just routinely?
So remember that most of our parents are immunized against measles. And if you have a child that's very young, there's potentially maternal antibody on board. That mother has passed her antibody she made from being vaccinated as a child to her now child. And so if you give measles vaccine too young, you might actually have mom's antibodies on board that may decrease the take of that vaccine. So that vaccine is typically given at a year of age when maternal antibody is worn off. But as a precaution for children who are traveling to areas where there is endemic measles, that vaccine can be given as early as 6 months of age.
And you mentioned there are sometimes a couple of different shots that have to be given?
Measles MMR vaccine or measles, mumps, rubella is typically you get two doses. You get the first dose when you're 12 to 15 months of age, and 95% of children will respond to that dose and develop immunity to measles. You get a second dose when you're typically 4 to 6 years of age, when you're getting ready to go into school. And that is not a booster dose. That is to maybe catch up anybody who didn't respond to the first dose.
Oh, okay. This is complicated.
It is complicated.
Yeah.
So what makes measles, I think, even more complicated is that it starts out with fever and upper respiratory symptoms. So children will have fever as high as 104 degrees, then maybe develop cough and a runny nose. And it pretty much can look like a lot of other viral respiratory illnesses that are out there. It's not until maybe day 3 or 4 into the illness that the rash hits that maybe you have a suspicion of measles.
And it's the rash that we all associate with measles, and that's what makes it kind of unique then.
But you talked about it being complicated. It is, because by the time the rash hits, you are already infectious and able to transmit infection to others 4 days prior. So you're infectious to others 4 days before the rash hits, the day of the rash, and for 4 days afterwards.
And it goes without saying, as you've already said, that the spreading the measles, it's really easy to do.
It is.
You don't need a degree in it. You can just go out and do it. Yeah.
It's an airborne disease, and you do not even have to be in the same room as a patient with measles in order to get measles. You can walk into a room up to 2 hours later after a person with measles has been there and still get disease.
Is that the way it is with other infectious diseases as well?
It's the way with varicella or chickenpox, and then can be that way with tuberculosis or TB as well.
Why does that stuff linger so long?
Very small droplets that linger in the air. And so it takes a while for that to then drift down and get onto surfaces.
You know, there's so many things to be worried about out there, Natasha, and, you know, Robin's making me worried about more stuff here, you know?
It's true, and it's appropriate caution, and it's important to be talking about for our Kansas City community to make sure they're protected, but I think the important point here is that we do have an action step to take, that if you are going to be traveling this summer, if you are going to be taking young infants abroad, you need to talk to your pediatrician about getting vaccinated before you go if they're over the age of 6 months, and it's a nice reminder of the reason why that we vaccinate our kids on time. We get in for that birthday visit. We talk to our pediatricians. We get our MMR. We get protected. And then we have the ability to sit back and have a greater level of comfort for our families.
Robin, why don't we just slow down here for a moment and talk for a moment about what exactly is the measles?
Okay. The measles is a virus that is one of the most infectious viruses known. If someone is not immune to measles and they are exposed to someone that has measles, there is a 90% chance that they will get measles. It is the most contagious of the vaccine-preventable diseases.
The most contagious, even more so than chickenpox.
Yes.
Yeah. You said a few minutes ago it takes a few days before the rash begins to show up. Remind us what the rash looks like.
The rash typically starts on the head. And so we're telling families, look first behind the ears and then the hairline and then on the face.
Does it itch?
It's usually not typically itchy. It is red and you can feel it. We call it a macular papular type rash. It'll feel kind of a little bit lumpy bumpy. It's not like a sunburn where you can run your hands over it and not feel it. And so then that rash then begins to spread throughout the rest of the body. So starts on the head first, then goes to the chest, and then spreads out to the extremities.
So once you've been vaccinated, Natasha, as a kid for measles, how long does that last for, you know, for adults who are listening to this? Do we have to think about getting a booster or anything?
You know, you shouldn't. Most adults who have been born in the 1950s or later have been vaccinated with a vaccine that's going to be able to be protective. And before then, especially, I have a lot of families that are calling and saying, you know, my grandma maybe was exposed. So is this important for my grandma? And, you know, and Dr. Livingston, mm-hmm. you can correct me, but most of our grandparents have already seen wild type measles in our community. If you've seen that disease, if you've had measles, you have lifelong protection. You have no need to worry. For some of my younger parents who do not have two documented experiences with the measles vaccine, I'm recommending that those young families also have the parents get vaccinated.
They can't remember or the records aren't complete. You
exactly.
better get vaccinated. And if you get vaccinated, then Dr. Livingston, how long does it take before the vaccine's effective?
We usually say get vaccine, and then within 2 weeks, you start developing an immunity to the vaccine you receive.
Within 2 weeks.
To the
okay.
Mm-hmm.
If our listeners have questions here as we kick around this whole idea of the measles, our number 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. How serious can this be, Natasha?
Oh, it can be very serious. I mean, we don't make vaccines for not serious diseases, right? Like there's hundreds of kids that die every day internationally of measles. So
hundreds of kids die every day from measles.
Absolutely. Still.
Yeah.
And there are common complications with respiratory symptoms that can cause brain, it can spread to the brain. Lots of kids need medical support at the hospital. And it's important to remember, too, that since measles is a virus, there's no medicine that we can give you to make it go away once you have it. Your body has to fight that infection on its own. And so if you do go to the hospital, it's just for supportive care as your body's fighting that infection. So it's a little bit different than some other of our vaccine preventable diseases that also do have antibiotics associated with their treatment.
So you guys, you know, work with measles cases all the time, but do you worry about catching them yourself?
Well, I'd say, how many cases of measles have you seen?
12.
12. I've seen 2, and I'm an infectious disease specialist who's been doing this for 17, 18 years now.
Why have you seen so few?
Well, remember that the vaccine came out in the 1960s. And so we in the United States went to having between 3 and 4 million cases a year to the numbers that we quoted earlier. Hmm. You know, measles was, the U.S. was considered measles free back in 2000. So now that the measles that we do have is typically brought in by travelers.
So that's why this thing isn't spreading like wildfire right now in Johnson County, because most people have been vaccinated.
Absolutely. But we have to keep in mind of our special people of our population, and those are our infants under the age of 1 who haven't had the vaccine. That's why we're hearing about it from daycare centers. That's why we're hearing about it from these places where these young infants are together, where they even haven't had the opportunity to get vaccinated. So I think although we're very fortunate that in Kansas City, in general, our vaccine rates are very high. And we do have to remember that most of our families, the vast majority of our families, get all of their vaccines on time. And that's really important. But there are still populations that just haven't had the opportunity to get it yet.
I was going to say the Star listed some of the places where children may have been exposed. How about if you visited one of those exposure sites and you're worried about getting a possible infection, what should you do?
So this is what we're asking families to do when they come into the Children's Mercy System. If you are part of the investigation. If we know that you've been exposed to measles, you have been informed by the health department, whether you're a member of the daycare or whether it's been through a doctor's office or whether you've been through the Children's Mercy system. So if you come into Children's Mercy, you need to say, I was called by someone and told my child might have been exposed to measles. Mm-hmm. If we don't get that history from you and we think that your child may be symptomatic with measles, we'll pull that press release from the health department and ask, have you been to any of those places on the list where you were potentially exposed? If the answer is no and we still think measles, we'll continue. We'll do the appropriate testing. And we need to make sure that we put you in the correct even hospital room when you come in to decrease the risk of exposure to the other staff and families that are present there at the same time.
But why would someone be hospitalized for measles?
We've actually had 4 children hospitalized at Children's Mercy during this outbreak with measles. Many, remember, they have very high fevers and they have become dehydrated, so they've come in for IV fluids. You can also get croup-type symptoms with measles, even a pneumonia. And so some children have come in not only for IV fluids, but for some oxygen therapy as well.
Man, okay, so all kinds of stuff here.
And I would like to ditto Dr. Levinson's comment, too, that if you're calling your primary pediatrician's office, that's important to let them know, too, because in our offices, we have protocols to isolate these kids to make sure that we are keeping our families safe.
So if someone does come in to pediatric associates, you don't want them exposed to the rest of the
absolutely.
Population,
and,
obviously.
And our office, and including I know other pediatric offices around the country, around the city and around the country, we all have protocols to keep all of our families safe, and that's super mm-hmm. important. So we need to have that communication from the families, and we need to be honest about your vaccine status.
We're talking about an outbreak of measles in the Johnson County area with Dr. Natasha Burgert with Pediatric Associates and Dr. Robin Livingston, who's with Children's Mercy. So how do you treat the measles, Robin? If you're home and you're taking care of your child, what do you do?
So not every child with measles needs to be admitted to the hospital.
Right.
The goal would be to hopefully they could stay at home to decrease the risk of exposure and transmission to others. But as I mentioned, 4 of these children have been sick enough to be hospitalized. So if your child is not eating or drinking and you worry about dehydration, they need to come in for IV fluids. If they are having respiratory issues, they need to come in for supportive care as well.
Okay, and just they can come in and get a few things going, right. Then go home and hopefully
the
deal with the rest of it.
The goal is to treat these children through the acute stage of their illness while still protecting the rest of our staff, patients, and families from measles.
If you catch the measles, how long are you going to be sick, typically?
Typically, I'd say 7 to 10 days.
Okay, so it's a long-running deal.
It is.
You're going to be out of school for a couple of weeks.
Yes. You are at least out of school till feeling better until your rash has to be gone for at least 4 days.
You know, Natasha, there's been all kinds of talk about vaccinations in this country in recent years. What about the measles vaccine? How effective is it, and what do we know about it?
The measles vaccine is highly effective. Just like Dr. Levinson said, you know, we're going to give one dose in the vast, vast majority, up to 95% of kids and people are going to have protection against those illnesses. I think really when we're talking about the MMR and specifically with our information in Missouri, when we had a mumps outbreak recently locally in our state, I think some of the investigation about the MMR is not so much for the measles component, but for the mumps component to make sure that we are maintaining our protection for the mumps component.
So kids these days, you go through the measles, you go through chickenpox, and you go through mumps. Are those the trio of bad things that most kids are exposed to?
Well, yeah, they're exposed to them. I've unfortunately seen more measles than chickenpox in my career, but I think that I've also started to see those mumps. So I think what's important is you know, that's what science is. Nature is going to, despite science's best attempt, nature's going to try as best as it can to keep these infectious particles around in our world. And so it's the job of our rigorous scientists to kind of keep on this ever-changing discipline of infectious disease to keep our population as healthy as it can be. And we're very thankful for all their work.
Robin Livingston, are those the 3 big ones that all kids get? Am I covering all 3 of them?
Well, I would say probably the most vaccine-preventable infection is flu.
Ah, okay. The flu as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But do all kids sort of run through chicken pox, mumps, and measles?
Well, I'd say they used to. But since the vaccines became available, I mean, look, I'm an infectious disease doctor, and I think I've seen maybe 5 good cases of chicken pox in my entire career because of the vaccine.
Okay. But those used to be the ones that people worried about the most then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Polio. I mean, you talk to, say, individuals, the grandparents of children who actually saw these diseases before vaccines were available, who went through measles, mumps, polio.
Mm-hmm. That's scary.
Well, you're also the medical director of infection prevention and control at Children's Mercy. What other infections do you worry about?
All of them.
There's a million of them.
So my role at Children's Mercy is to make sure that our patients, families, visitors, and our employees do not get infections, whether that be from patients coming in who are infection to children who have surgeries. We don't want them to get a post-op surgical infection. We want to put practices in place to decrease risk to everyone that comes through our doors.
That's a pretty big job.
And it's been busier over the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. That's Dr. Robin Livingston. She's the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control over at Children's Mercy. Dr. Natasha Berger is going to hang around. We're going to transition here in our second half and talk about getting your kids ready for summertime activities. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we heard about how one southwestern Kansas town is coping 1 year after the biggest wildfire in state history. You can hear that episode at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, it's opening day at the K. We'll head to Kauffman Stadium for a look at the Royals' upcoming season, the players to watch, and what's brewing at Boulevard. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we're continuing with our children's health show today, and now we're going to switch topics and kick around how to make sure your kids are ready for all the time they soon will be spending outdoors once the weather warms. We're talking sports, we're talking about playing outside and camping and hiking, all that good stuff. With us again, Dr. Natasha Burgert with Pediatric Associates, and we're joined now by David Seastrom. He's a registered nurse and is the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Trauma Services Department at Children's Mercy. And David, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, kids are going to be spending more time outside soon, David. One thing that some kids gravitate towards is all-terrain vehicles. And I know you see ATV injuries with some regularity. What advice would you toss out to families that own an ATV?
You're absolutely right. ATVs are very popular, especially in the rural communities in the Midwest where we have them all the time. So there are a couple things that we always tell folks. You know, kids are injured and even killed on ATVs every single year. And so
we knew one in our family.
The mortality rate, the death rate has just continued to climb as ATVs become more popular and more powerful. So, you know, a couple things that we always tell people is we don't want anybody, if they can't drive a car, they shouldn't probably drive an ATV.
Oh, really?
That's the first thing. Secondly, you know, riding at nighttime is the most dangerous time. They're off-road
vehicles.
Because
you can't see what's ahead of you.
Yeah, then other people can't see you. And there's really not a lot of regulations that say, you know, ATVs don't have to have daytime running lights like, you know, a lot of cars are now. So visibility is a big thing. You know, they're off-road vehicles. They're not on-road vehicles. So they really should never be ridden on highways and roadways and things like that.
There haven't been a lot of rules, laws passed regarding ATVs. Am I catching that?
100%. Yeah, there's
Why
not
would that be?
That's a good question.
That's one of the things you wonder about, probably.
It really is. There's not a lot of safety regulations. You know, they don't have to have roll cages. One of the biggest things is helmet use decreases a kid's, traumatic brain injuries, the leading cause of death and trauma for children. And that's just one of those things when kids get flung from ATVs or crash into trees. You know, they have big heads and little bodies. They always go first with their head. And so helmets is just a really simple way that we could decrease the amount of injuries that kids are getting on ATVs also.
Yeah, just for some context here, I'm curious, from your vantage point, would you ban ATVs if you were king of the world? And you should be, as we all know.
Well, I don't know about that. I grew up in a really small town, and I had an ATV as a kid, and I'm probably lucky to be alive. I don't know that banning them, per se, is the right thing, but I think there should be some safety measures put in place and required for all of them. I mean, we want kids to have fun just like everybody else does. We just want them to do it in a safe manner.
Natasha Berger, should they be banned?
You know, I ditto David's comments that especially coming from originally Nebraska and rural communities that were really common growing up as well. And so I think that there are safer ways to do it. And I think that just kids are on them a little bit too young. I would also ditto that for golf carts that are increasingly popular in the suburban neighborhoods. And I have certainly seen some reckless activity on those as well.
So you're saying maybe, as David just did, that maybe you should be at least 16, able to drive a car before you can drive an ATV.
I think that just makes sense.
Okay. What about bringing kids along as passengers on ATVs?
I think our stance would be that typically the passengers are also injured. It's really not the best idea. And I would kind of echo what she said was, you know, if you're not old enough to drive a car, we really are pretty immature when you're young, and your decision making at high speed and even in tense situations is not great. So you're just adding risk to, you know, putting somebody else on there is just adding risk. Like a teenager driving a car, having passengers makes them much more likely to be in a crash because they get distracted and start playing around.
You said a couple of minutes ago that you think you're lucky to be alive because when you were a kid, you had an ATV yourself. And you probably have stories about stuff you used to do,
stupid
right?
Stupid things. We used to jump it into the pond just because it sounded fun.
What'd you do?
We used to jump it over a hill into the pond.
Into the water?
Mm-hmm. They float.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, you just look back at things and go, oh, how bad of decisions was I making back then?
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned protective gear. Helmet goes without saying, David. Anything else that makes sense?
I think, you know, helmets, especially if they have a front shield or a eye protection, is really nice. Any of the shin pads, kind of the motocross people that you see, they're riding motorcycles and have shin pads and chest protectors and all of those kind of things. All of those things would be appropriate. And clothing that's really reflective and very colorful just helps people see you on the thing. You know, we think about just motorcycles on the roadway, and half of them get hit because people don't see them because they're not looking for those kind of things.
You know, Natasha, just a sister to the ATV, maybe a sorry sister is the bicycle, and kids will be riding bikes here pretty soon. They haven't been riding very much the past few months, but they will be soon. What should parents be thinking about there?
Well, I think we have to kind of go into the garage and rummage around and get all the dust and dirt off of all our equipment, but really making sure that the equipment fits, like not just running into the garage and having your kid grab the same bike helmet that they did last year. We've got to think about their growth over the course of these last few months and still making sure everything fits properly.
Because helmets come in different sizes.
Yeah, they come in different sizes, and just readjusting the straps and all that kind of stuff too to make sure that they're fitting properly. There's some great YouTube videos and information online about how to properly fit a bike helmet so it's not too far back, it's not too far forward, because if you're going to wear the piece of equipment, you want to wear it correctly. And if the wheels are turning, we want to make sure that there's a helmet on there. I start that habit even from the kids that are cruising around in the driveway on tricycles, just to get them in a good habit of always having a helmet on there and then all the way through. And please, 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 I love seeing families out biking, but mom and dad need helmets too. I often see lots of families that their kids have awesome helmets and good safety equipment, and then the parents are just out there cruising around. And remember that we are the best examples, so we need helmets too.
Well, because my generation didn't grow up with them.
Of course not.
And as you know, I ride my bike to work here a lot, and I wear a helmet. I got to tell you, I hate that.
No, I know. Totally agree. As well as the knee pads and the elbow pads and everything else when we're roller skating, because we never did that either.
Yeah.
And so, but it's a good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. And David, you would second that notion?
100%.
And even starting kids on tricycles wearing helmets at that point.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you said my generation, we weren't having that stuff. I again, grew up in a small town, and we never wore a seatbelt. We were going three blocks to the store and three blocks home. So it wasn't normal for me. But I think kids over the years have, you know, parents have started putting them in car seats and safety restraints and booster seats. And now it's just habit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a good point that we start them young and it just becomes a habit. Every time they get on the bike or around one, they've got their helmet ready.
What about rollerblades or skateboards?
Same thing. We would just tell you, that, like she said, the elbow pads, knee pads, you know, helmet, absolutely.
And it's a good opportunity, too, when kids are starting to cruise around the neighborhood to talk about just neighborhood navigation, how to cross the street. Just remind those kids of, like, basic stuff because they haven't been outside cruising around the neighborhood. And a nice reminder for our communities that, you know, kids are going to be out soon. So our caution as drivers through our neighborhoods has to go up a little bit. But reminding kids how to properly cross the street with the bike, making sure we have information on their kids about their identification, just kind of a good refresher as part of our spring cleaning to kind of see where our kids are, not only physically, but developmentally, to navigate those skills on their own.
Natasha, let's turn to sports. Many kids are involved in multiple sports these days. How worried should we be about overextending and overexertion when it comes to kids and the multiple sports they play?
Meaning overscheduling, or
yeah, they play too many sports, maybe just wear themselves out.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that seems to be the case, especially for my kiddos that have like multiple sports every season. And one thing that we do know is that we don't want kids to specialize too early. So there is a benefit for them to have varied activities. And I think every family can tolerate the number of activities differently. A general rule of thumb is kids should be in an hour of practice for their year of age. So if you have a 7-year-old that's in 20 hours of gymnastic a week, that's too much. Huh. So as a general rule of thumb, an hour per age. Otherwise, we have to...
An hour per age per week. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And I think we discredit how much kids learn social skills and cognitive development and creative play just by playing. Mm-hmm. And it's okay just to kind of let your kids play outside and let them go get dirty and play with sticks and all that kind of stuff and see what happens. And I say that as a pediatrician. I know that their injuries do happen with creative play, but I think that that's really important to not schedule your kids all the time.
So you call it creative play. You mean you don't have to be in a league to go outside and play with sticks and stuff like that?
Surprisingly, no.
You don't, but...
It's a lot cheaper that way, too.
You actually have to call it creative play to distinguish it from everything else that we do these days. Yeah. What are some of the most common injuries that you guys see from sports, David?
Fractures would be the biggest probably thing that we see all the time, and our orthopedic surgeons are just doing a fantastic job. But that's probably the most common thing we see. But shortly after that, it's the concussions that are so prevalent in kids, and it's not just basketball and football like we think about it. Really, is sports like cheerleading is one of those other things where they're not wearing protective equipment, and if they do fall and smack their head. So concussions and fractures are probably the two biggest things I would think about.
How often do you see concussion cases? I'm surprised
every single day.
You say it really, even not in connection with football.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's football got the hype because of its so violence at times in the NFL and the lawsuits and stuff. But it really is. Oh, yeah. It's gym class. You get elbowed in the head, or cheerleading. You fall off the pyramid and smack the gym floor, or basketball. You get hit in the head with a ball. And soccer is kind of the newest thing they've been thinking about, whether kids are always jumping and heading the soccer ball and hitting it with their head. So it's really all of those sports, there's always that risk out there for it. And
are you seeing it more often because you're looking for it more closely now than you did a few years ago because there's been so much attention paid to it? Is that what's going on there?
I think so. I mean, I think we've learned over probably the last 7 to 10-ish years, we've learned way more about concussions than we ever knew in the past. So I think it's more prevalence on the forefront of everybody's mind. And we now know that there really are long-term effects, maybe linked to Alzheimer's or dementia and some of those things with repeated multiple concussions.
How about you, Natasha? How often do you see concussions in your practice?
Oh, we see at least a couple times a week. And I completely agree with David that it's not just the football. Tons of cheerleading. Lacrosse is a popular one, too. And kids just on the playground. I think parents are more aware. There's been a lot of great important media around to make parents aware. The most common symptom of concussion that we see in the office is headache.
I was going to say, when a kid comes in, how do you know if he or she has suffered a concussion?
Well, some of them are clearly obvious. They look like they've had their bell rung. They're talking slow, they're dazed, they're not acting themselves. And especially for the kids that we know well that come to the pediatrician often, we can usually tell that they're not right. The challenges is especially as we're getting into finals time, this can also coincide with cognitive problems, academic problems, when their brain isn't working right after a concussion with all their demands of school. So it's an important thing to kind of keep in place. I've also had a lot of parents go out of their way to spend a lot of money on kind of niche products to try to prevent concussions, which I try to discourage. There hasn't been any solid evidence that any special mouth guard or special helmet that you can buy for hundreds of dollars is going to prevent that in your child. So it's still getting the right equipment, playing by the rules, knowing the symptoms of concussion when your kid has them, and seeking professional help.
How do you treat one when they come in the door?
Time
patience. Away from
time,
school and
patients, some symptomatic treatment, but a concussion in its most simplistic form, a concussion is a bruise on the brain. And how do you fix a bruise? You wait. You know, you have to wait for the body to fix it.
You know, David, that's one of the great, misconceptions, I think, about the NFL. NFL, these teams are spending all this money on these fancy helmets, and that doesn't prevent a concussion from happening because it's the movement of the brain inside the skull where you have the bruising occurring that Natasha just referred to, right?
Yeah, she's 100% correct. I mean,
She always
niche
is.
Products out there. I'm learning that.
I don't know how well you know her. She always is. Yeah.
All those products out there, I mean, there really hasn't been anything that says this helmet really does help. Then that's kind of the unfortunate thing. And, you know, playing by the rules and being safe and spearing, all those things that we shouldn't do, spearing and those kind of really do helpfully decrease the amount of it. But, yeah, it's the normal stuff of being safe, teaching them the rules, you know, wearing the appropriately sized equipment, which I found is one of the bigger things, you know. When I started high school, they said, "Oh, here's the helmet room. Go grab a helmet."
Yeah, right.
Tight, loose, comfortable.
Right,
you know?
Of course.
So a little bit of guidance, I think, goes a really long way with those kind of things.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the other, to extend what David said too, with all the fractures, I had three kids last year in the springtime have a unique fracture for a very specific reason, and that was going down a slide on their parents' lap. And
really,
yes. And so I know it sounds.
How does that happen?
So. You know, we all want to take our kids, the first sign of spring, we want to take our toddlers and young children out to the park. And a lot of parks have really high slides that's too high for a toddler to go in by themselves. So we climb up to the top and we throw our toddler on our lap and go down with them and say we and have a good time. Well, what happens is toddlers, if you may remember, a toddler is an unpredictable little being. And in the excitement of going down the slide, they often fling appendages out the side of the protective lap. And so it's not uncommon that kids fling their legs out while the parent's going down, get it caught between the side of the parent's leg and the slide and break their legs.
Oh, ow.
Yeah. So I had three. Ow. Yeah, I know. It's a known injury. It's a common injury, but people's, and I don't want to be the fun police here, but I do want people to be aware that it is a common way that toddlers break their legs. And so if you're choosing to do that activity, just to remember the mechanism of that injury and to keep all legs and arms in the moving device.
You just see it all, don't you?
Well, that's the joy of pediatrics, yeah. Right?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about how to keep your kids safe and protected over the course of the warm weather months that are coming up down the road here. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number. You know, David, I'm just wondering, how often do parents ask you, going back to the whole concussion thing, which makes me think about football, do parents ask you about whether it's safe for their kids to play football these days?
Oh, that's a pretty good question.
Do you get it a lot?
I think we really do. And like she said, we don't want to be the fun police or kill all the kids' fun. And I think, you know, that builds teamwork. It builds interpersonal skills. It develops a lot of other stuff. There are ways to be safe while doing it. You know, the appropriate equipment, playing by the rules, being safe while we do it. I think that kids can be fairly safe when they're playing those sports activities. And I think they really enjoy that kind of stuff. And, you know, like she said earlier, sometimes you got to play outside and get hurt. That's, you know, sometimes that happens for kids. But there's important cognitive things that really go along with that, too.
Well, I mean, have you reached a point, to be more pointed, I guess, have you reached a point where when someone asks you, is it safe for my kid to play football, do you say no?
I don't. I think the vast, vast, vast majority of children play and don't really have any bad things that occur. There will always be the unlucky one that gets the concussion or has a delayed recovery from it. We can't tell you who that will be and who it won't be.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't tell them to. I don't say no. I think it's good for kids to do those kind of things, and you know we all kind of learn by mistake sometimes.
Natasha, how do you handle that question?
Well, I mean, I'm a Husker. I come from Husker Nation, right? Like, so football is ingrained with us in the Midwest, I think, and it's a little bit different of the conversation that people are having on the coast, quite honestly. But I think, you know, all I can say is, you know, my son, I've got a second grader. He's never asked to play football, which has made that easier in our family.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to face that decision.
Yeah.
What would you say?
You know, I agree with David. I think that the reason a lot of injuries happen is because it's a popular sport. There's a ton of kids that play it. And so it's just it's a numbers game as part of it. And I think the vast majority of the kids that I care for that play volleyball, lacrosse, football, soccer, the vast majority of them don't get hurt. But they do have to have the right equipment and play by the rules.
No, Natasha, a minute ago you mentioned this notion of athletic gear and how some of it's really not that effective. It can be expensive. The cost can add up quickly. Is there some must-have gear, you know, for sports that you would say that kids really need to think about? I mean, like mouth guards for any kind of sport, for example?
Yeah, I mean, mouth guards is a big one. Obviously, helmets is a big one and pretty universal. I know that some soccer teams are experimenting with some kind of headpiece devices. I think it really depends on the league that you're playing, the level that you're playing at, and the experience of your kid.
Yeah. David, did you throw anything into that?
I would. I would just kind of add on to hers and say, not that I don't worry about high school kids, but I really worry about the kids who are playing football in the park with dads on Saturdays, because there isn't any oversight. They may not have great equipment. It might be old, not really fitting so well. So I really worry about the toddlers and the little ones who are playing in those not even really leagues. They're just down in the park on Saturday with a bunch of friends playing around. That's where I get real concerned, because there really isn't any oversight for those kind of things.
Our number, if our listeners want to call about questions related to kids' activities over the summertime, how to get them ready for that, 816-235-2888. JR from Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Been talking about equipment and everything, and I'm coming at it from the biker's angle. You talked about helmets. If a biker has a helmet and they take a spill and the helmet gets dinged, that helmet is done. Should only have one ding. The second time it won't protect you.
Is that right? Natasha's nodding her head, JR. Hang on a second here.
There's just a thin plastic shell over foam, and if that shell gets broken, the helmet's broken.
Okay, the shell's broken. Yeah, I get that.
No, I think that's a great point, JR, and appreciate that call. I think we underestimate the amount of force that also is in the foam and has helped protect even when we don't see a specific crack in the helmet outside. Mm-hmm. Very similar to a car seat. If you're in a significant accident at the car seat, it needs to be replaced even if there's no visible damage to the seat. That's the same kind of comment for the helmet. So that's true.
JR, did you have another point you wanted to make about distracted drivers?
Yeah, basically, it's getting worse and worse. The people are spending more time on their phones in their cars and not paying attention. I was nearly clobbered in Johnson County last fall because if I hadn't looked three times before I crossed with the light, some guy would have plowed into me at 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And the cop shop wouldn't do anything, even though I had him on my action cam, because I couldn't identify him.
All right, JR, thank you. And more good advice there. A couple other things I wanted to get to before our time is up here. Dehydration. How much water should kids be drinking, Natasha?
Oh, that's a great thing. Hydration and sleep are two really great preventatives. So hydration needs to be with water. It doesn't need to be with fancy sports drinks. Kids need to be drinking water pretty much continuously.
Are fancy sports drinks better?
No. Water, water, water.
Okay. Keep it simple.
And keep them with a water bottle, because it's really hard, like right before practice or right after practice, they guzzle, guzzle, guzzle. It's really about maintaining hydration for you and I and our kids all day long. And a lot of schools have various policies about having water bottles in the classroom. But I know any pediatrician would be happy to write a note so they can have that water bottle all year long.
David, give me 20 seconds on sunscreen. And again, a bigger issue today than it was when I was a little kid.
Absolutely wear it. That's the whole take home. And, you know, I always remind people that kids, their thin is skinner. It's burnt much more easily than your and mine as the parent is. So, you know, they're going to get burnt worse and easier than you or I. So frequently reapplying, waterproof is the best. Every 2 hours, probably, if not more, if they're sweating it off or in the water.
That waterproof sunscreen, that is different than other kinds of sunscreen?
It is. It actually stays on a little bit longer. So, but even after every probably 2 hours or so, they probably should reapply that even.
Okay, yeah. Good advice.
SPF yeah. at least 30.
And one last shameless plug for the pediatrician is for all of these sports camps, all of these camps coming up, we have tons of forms coming into our office because everybody needs a checkup and everybody needs a form. So call now.
Okay. That's Dr. Natasha Burgert with Pediatric Associates. She was joined by David Seastrom. He's a registered nurse. He's the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Trauma Services Department at Children's Mercy. David, you did a great job. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having
me. Natasha, always good to have you here.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, Steve.
Yesterday in the program, how the town of Ashland, Kansas bounced back from the biggest wildfire in state history and how they're dealing with this year's fire season. You can hear that conversation. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we head out to the K for opening day and we'll find out what's new this year for our Kansas City Royals. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.